final case for oral argument this morning is Sean Springer Appellant versus the State of South Dakota. For the appellant, we have Ms. Jamie Damon, an attorney from Pierre, and for the state, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general, also from Pierre. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Ron Rohrer, a circuit judge from the Third Circuit in the eastern end of the state, to sit in Justice Zinner's behalf. With that, Ms. Damon, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes. There's a little stool under there, if that helps.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'll fall off.
Okay. We can see you fine.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jamie Damon. I'm here on behalf of Sean Springer. I was not his trial attorney, and I got involved in this case a couple of years ago, and then Sean had filed a pro se application to have his case be heard for resentencing based on the trilogy of cases of Roper, Graham, and Miller. Sean's case, while it doesn't actually fit into any of those cases, it is a hybrid, and it's kind of carved out its own niche based on some of the cases that have come out of Iowa since Roper, Graham Miller trilogy has come about. Sean was arrested on January 26th when he was 1996, when he was 16 years old. He was involved in the kidnapping of Michael Hare, a Pierre cab driver. Sean was not the one who actually pulled the trigger. However, Sean had a background such that he had been in and out of group homes, and from what I can tell, fairly unsuccessfully. He was involved in plotting to steal the gun, or perhaps he stole it, and Sean had said during his pre-sentence interview that he admitted to stealing the gun, he admitted to stealing the cab, and he said that he hoped to get $100 out of the whole deal. His buddy, Paul Jensen, is the one who actually pulled the trigger. They took the cab driver kind of on a wild goose chase. The cab driver had left the radio on, so people had some idea of what was going on. Mr. Hare was shot outside of the cab by Paul Jensen. And Sean Springer is the one who then started to drive the cab away. There was some brief chase with law enforcement, and Sean ended up driving the cab into a snowbank. Both of these kids, because Paul Jensen was 14 and Sean Springer was 16, both of these kids were charged separately, and their cases basically took different paths at that time. Sean had a transfer hearing, and Judge Gores was his judge at the time. He had a three-day transfer hearing, and at the end of it, Judge Gores considered some issues and said he was charging him as an adult. Prior to the start of the trial, which after a change of venue, the trial was going to be in Selby, South Dakota, and while I believe they were still during voir dire, and a plea agreement was reached. It was put on the record, there was a written plea agreement, and then eventually there was a 2 or 3 day deposition. Sean also ended up testifying in Paul's case. Sean he was charged with 13 counts, one of which included the death penalty. By pleading, the death penalty and I believe the case dismissed the count one first degree murder, so the death penalty was off the table. But what was still on the table in a number of these counts was life in prison, mandatory life without the possibility of parole. Both sides were free to argue whatever they chose to argue for sentencing. And Sean decided that he was taking a sentence which hopefully would help him avoid life without the possibility of parole. He did plead guilty to kidnapping, but he didn't plead to the kidnapping charge that had the extra penalties on it. So after he pled, after his deposition, after he testified against Paul Jensen, he was sentenced on October 15, 1996. At that time, Judge Gore sentenced him to life, or sentenced him to 261 years with credit for time served, which was just a few months. At that time, Judge Gore told him, because he was under the old parole system. The new parole system started, I believe, in July of 1996, so he was under the old parole system. And that is important in this case, because under the old parole system, it's discretionary whether or not he would get parole. So Judge Gore said to him that life without the possibility of parole, because the judge acknowledged he was under the old parole system, and the sentencing court stated that he would not flat time until 132 years. 132 years is obviously beyond his natural life. And the judge said, this is beyond your lifetime. So in effect, this is a life sentence. The judge did say that, he said, but there is a glimmer of hope down the road, because with your being a first-time offender, you would be eligible for parole by my calculation at the age of 33 years. This gives you the opportunity to convince someone in the future that you can be trusted to be back out of prison. The problem is, and the reason why we're here, is because, number one, under a discretionary parole system, there is no assurance he would ever receive parole. That's entirely up to the parole board at that time. So the 30th, and I believe he got, I think it's around 33 years before he is eligible, before he is even eligible for a discretionary parole. So
how close is he to that 33-year benchmark?
I believe it's 2029.
Okay.
Somewhere
so another 15 years, give or take.
Yes.
All right.
And so my concern is when I look at this trilogy of cases, there were three cases that came about in the past several years. One case is Roper, which was a 2005 case. Roper, and all of these are U.S. Supreme Court cases. Roper abolished a death sentence for a juvenile, even if they're charged out as an adult. Then in 2010, the Graham case came along. Graham said, hey, it's unconstitutional to give life in prison without the possibility of parole on non-homicide cases. Then in 2012, you have Miller v. Alabama, which said it's unconstitutional to give life in prison to a juvenile charged as an adult on a homicide case. So granted, we're not talking, even though there was a homicide involved in this, Sean Springer was not convicted and did not plead to a homicide. He pled to a kidnapping. My concern is he received what I consider a de facto life sentence. And the reason why I say that is he does not flat time until 132 years, which is beyond his lifetime, which goes against what these cases say, that you have to take into consideration differences. And I think the reason why the courts did that is all three of the cases talk about, they talk about over the years, there have been many more studies done that juveniles' brains are less well-developed, that juveniles are immature, they are more impulsive, they do stupid things, basically, without thinking of the consequences. And they came up with a bunch of factors. And each case kind of built upon the other. So you had Miller, then you have Graham building upon, excuse me, you had Roper, then Graham building upon Roper, and then you had Miller. And Miller stated that that you need to look at factors that I call the Miller factors. You need to look at the chronological age and related immaturity and impetuousness and failure to appreciate risk and consequences. If you tie this back into Sean Springer, you know, here this kid says, well, I'm going to steal a gun, we're going to steal a cab, and maybe we'll get $100. I mean, he obviously was not thinking long term, and they were being quite impetuous with what they were doing. Another thing that Miller says that you look at is the family and home environment, the circumstances of the homicide, the incompetency of youth in dealing with law enforcement in the adult criminal justice system, and the possibility of rehabilitation. Miller also said that you need to look at the gaps between adults and juveniles and how they have developed. And Miller cited Roper for saying that you look at the lack of maturity and underdeveloped sense of responsibility. You look at vulnerability to negative influences and outside pressures, and the lack of a juvenile to extricate themselves from those situations. And you also look at the character is not well formed in children. Traits are less fixed in children, and their actions are less likely to be evidence of irretrievable depravity. So the way I understand it, what they're saying is, hey, you've got this kid, there still is some hope there. And the interesting thing is when you look at these cases and when you look at the cases that came out of Iowa in the past couple of years, Ragland and the Pearson case, which are two cases that said we're looking at these factors when we were sentencing juveniles, you know, they were saying you need to look at these mitigation factors. And they look at them in a totally different way than was looked back in 1996. In fact, back in 1996, one of the things that at the transfer hearing that Judge Gore said when he came up with the factors, none of which, by the way, were mitigation factors. Today, the mitigation factors are kind of turned around, that the negatives that Judge Gore said, some of the negatives that he felt required a transfer into adult court, now they're saying you need to look at these factors because these children are not as well developed. Their brains are not as well developed. And the things that Judge Gore's looked at back in 1996 as a negative today would be looked at, quite frankly, as a positive because it's mitigation. Because Sean Springer did have a lengthy juvenile record, but there was no psychologist that testified at any stage of the proceedings for Sean Springer. There wasn't a psychologist who testified or any psychological tests done at the time of his transfer hearing, and there certainly weren't at the time of his sentencing hearing. In fact, the pre-sentence report.
All right, but Ms. Damon, you're asking us to look at resentencing at this point, but to get to where the Miller case is, do we look at the date for eligibility of parole, or do we look at the 261 years? Is that what was 261 years? If we look at eligibility for parole, is that, and that's 31 or 36 years, I believe you said, would that be a violation of Miller?
I believe that it would. And under the Pearson case from the state of Iowa, which was, they were looking at Pearson was looking at 35 years to reach parole on a 50-year sentence. And the state of Iowa still said, you have to look at it. The difference is, and I couldn't tell it from the Pearson case, which is only 2 years longer than when Sean Springer is eligible for parole. The difference is, I didn't get from reading that case, the Pearson case, that Pearson is, I believe is a girl, that Pearson is subject to a discretionary parole system. And that's a huge difference when you're looking at a discretionary parole system versus a mandatory parole system. Because in a mandatory parole system, which South Dakota now has, assuming that you haven't gotten a ton of write-ups or whatever, your chances are you're going to make your parole at the time that you are supposed to make it. And for instance, in the Owens case, which was recently before the circuit court, which was a homicide case in South Dakota, her sentence was reduced to 40 years.
2 minutes, counsel.
But, pardon?
2 minutes.
Okay. Her case was reduced to 40 years. So she is eligible because she's under the new parole system in 2018. Sean Springer has no assurance under the old parole system that he's ever going to get out. So if you don't take a look at this, who's going to? When the 33 years are up and he doesn't make his parole, then what? Then he's supposed to come back? I mean, the remedy is to look at it now. And I believe in the Pearson case that they also gave a little direction that sometimes maybe you need to look at the law combined, not just the separation of legislative and judicial branches. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Damon. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. As Judge Gore said, this case is but a glimmer of hope. And as Justice Severson pointed out, this is a term of years with the possibility of parole within the defendant's lifetime. That's what cases like Graham are focusing on. And 15 years from now, when Springer is 49, he will be eligible for parole. The new system is conditional. The old system is discretionary. You still have to fulfill your individual program directive and the conditions of parole under the new system. But in any event, when Judge Gores was fashioning this sentence, he did the math. He figured out that Springer needed time to mature, he needed time to rehabilitate, and around 49 or 50, he would be able to maybe re-enter society. He gave Springer light at the end of the tunnel. And that's what these cases and these trilogy of cases require. As far as age, I went through
well,
this.
Well, before we go there, Ms. Meyer, without considering parole, just the 261 years, would that be in violation of Miller?
Of Miller?
Yes.
No, because Springer wasn't convicted of murder. Springer was convicted of a non-homicide crime, and Graham would be the closest case to it if he'd gotten a life sentence without parole, which is what the state was adamantly asking for. But we don't fall within Miller because this is a non-homicide crime.
So you're saying he'd been better off to kill the person rather than to kidnap him?
Not saying that at all, because I represent the state. We don't believe in murder, but no.
But are you saying we can't look at the number of years and say 261 years is de facto life?
I'm saying it's a package. I'm saying that you have to look, just like Graham said, you have to look. And that's what the cases in Iowa are looking at. They're looking at whether this is within the lifetime of that particular juvenile who is on parole. You can't cut the natural lifetime off. And there's a number of cases that we've cited in our brief that some of these juveniles are coming out in their 60s. It isn't just Iowa controlling this whole scheme of cases out here or how things are developing for juveniles across the country. And it isn't just Miller that's controlling that. And I wanted to back up and talk about age. Judge Gores, when he was putting this together, he obviously was doing the math and figuring out where Springer would be best so that he could also have the chance to change, and so that society would be safe from his kind of actions. He did look at age. He said, I ultimately think that you should have the chance to rehabilitate in one so young. And I counted the number of times that two of the defense attorneys spoke at the sentencing hearing referred to age. Over 20, they used the word kid, child, this young man, the 17-year-old. Age was just permeating these proceedings. It was something the court was very concerned about, as were all the parties. And as far as experts, we in South Dakota are not a sentencing or trial by expert jurisdiction. We don't use behavioral software. It is within the discretion of the judge to determine a sentence. And we don't look at Judge Scores, the situation here. We don't require experts. He sat through this case all the way from the very beginning. He sat through it from the transfer hearing, which is exceedingly long. He went through the plea hearing, He went through a lengthy sentencing hearing. And he was intimately familiar with this case and the details of Sean Springer's life, which included his family situation. The fact he didn't have a father. The fact that he didn't have a lot of peer pressure showing him which way to go or which way not to go. Those things were all taken into account. And I don't think that looking at this record, Judge Gores missed a step or missed the spirit of the law with Graham or Miller or any of the cases that you see across the country dealing with juveniles. So I guess to sum up, this wasn't a one-size-fits-all sentencing hearing. There were a number of things that went into the equation, and Judge Gores did his job. If there are no further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Meyer.
Thank you.
Ms. Damon, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
One thing that Ms. Meyer said that concerned me based on my reading of these cases is she'd used the word behavioral software. And under the Roper, Graham, Miller trilogy, you do have to look at the behavior. You do have to consider different factors than were considered back in 1996 because we progressed since then. We know more about juveniles today than we knew in 1996. We know more, there are studies, I don't personally know, but as a society, we know more about what children are like. We know about their impetuousness. We know that they are not capable of making some of the decisions. One of the cases, and I can't think of which one right now, but one of the cases said when you give a child a life sentence, you are giving them more of a sentence than you are giving an adult. They are a child. They are younger. So a life sentence is much, much longer. And for anyone to say that a 261-year sentence, that you don't have any assurance that you are getting out because of the discretionary parole for 132 years. If that's not a life sentence, then I don't know what it is. And in fact, Judge—
Let me just ask, do those cases require assurance of some kind of release or meaningful opportunity? Isn't there a difference?
There is a difference, but—
And how do we say even the discretionary parole isn't a meaningful opportunity for release?
Well, if discretionary parole were a meaningful opportunity, then somebody who's had their sentence, like the one case Jenner, where her sentence got commuted, and there haven't been, from what I've followed, a lot of violations, and so she has discretionary parole, and that's gone on for years. So the parole system looks at different factors, and so
is there evidence in the record for us to rely on to make that determination that discretionary parole is not a meaningful opportunity for release?
I don't think anyone thinks that discretionary parole and the new parole system are the same. I've never gotten the impression that judges think that it's the same thing. I mean, I remember at the time when there was that changeover, and it seemed like, oh, what's going to happen to these people on the discretionary parole system? So I don't have any statistics on it. All I'm saying is when you look at a case like Pearson, which was a 2013 case where the girl was eligible at 35 years of a 50-year sentence, and the Iowa Supreme Court felt that because the typical factors such as immaturity, impetuous, poor risk assessments, none of that had been looked at, and that juveniles are more capable of change, they still remanded that case back for consideration. And one other thing I would like to point out to you is that Graham requires a meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation during an offender's expected lifetime. And Miller requires individualized consideration of youth as a mitigating factor. What we have here is we have a case where a child had, at the time he committed the crime, is dependent solely on a parole board who may or may not give him a discretionary parole. And if he doesn't get it, he, in effect, could likely serve a much longer sentence than someone who has committed murder, because we're saying this case doesn't count because you have a discretionary parole. I have nothing else.
Okay. Thank you very much. Nobody's criticized for quitting early.
Thank you.